ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey, I'm Sana Qadar, and I host All in the Mind on ABC Radio National. If you've ever wondered why people behave the way they do, or what it's like to live inside their heads, this is the show for you. We dive deep each week into a topic related to mental health or psychology, from the promise and perils of manifesting, to how to get better sleep, to what it's like to experience psychosis. Hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Welcome to The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford. So it's coming up to Christmas, which means that the sound of choral societies performing Messiah is in the air. But that's not how this piece started. When Handel wrote Messiah in just 3 weeks in 1741, he would never have thought it would become one of the most performed works in the canon, least of all, that it would become a Christmas staple. If anything, it's more of an Easter piece. And that's when its first performance took place, in April 1742 in Dublin. Really, though, it's a piece for all seasons. It's not a dramatic work, more philosophical, a chain of verses from the Hebrew and Christian Bibles that suggest, as the historian Charles King says, the staggering possibility that things might turn out all right. Charles King is the author of a wonderful book about the origins of Messiah, and it's good to be able to hear the conversation I had with him earlier this year again. Let's start at the beginning and with a recording that is 98 years old.
Thank you.
Comfort Ye My People, that's the opening accompanied recitative from Handel's Messiah, and that's a very special recording. It's from the first complete recording of Messiah, conducted by Thomas Beecham in 1927 with the BBC Choir and Orchestra. This is 3 years before the BBC Symphony Orchestra was even founded. And the tenor we heard, Hubert Isdell, who I had to look up, but when I looked him up, I discovered that he was married to Kitty Parker, the Australian composer, and indeed their son, Michael, became an ABC radio announcer, which is an honourable profession. I'm delighted to welcome to the music show the author of a book about Handel's Messiah and much else. It's called Every Valley, and the author is Charles King, and he joins me from his home in Washington, D.C., where he's Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University. Welcome to the show, Charles.
So nice to be with you, Andy. Thanks.
Before we talk about Handel's Messiah, we have to talk about that particular recording, which is so beautifully sung, I think, very expressive, because I think this is certainly the start of the book, and I think it's the start of your engagement, or deep engagement, with the making of this piece.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a historian. I write history books, but I'd never written about music before. But my wife, who is a singer and a performer, sort of fills our house with music. And one Valentine's Day, I thought a great gift would be a wind-up Victrola, you know, one of these old 1920s sort of wind-up things and in an oak case. And somehow in the middle of COVID and January 6th, we live six blocks from the U.S. Capitol. We were looking for some way of feeling better in the middle of some very trying times. And I had the idea that if I could find the oldest recording of Handel's Messiah, which is a piece of music that we've both loved over the years, and put it on this incredible acoustic-only recording device, that would somehow be some kind of big magic. And I found the Beecham recording and put it on. And in the middle of this really trying, globally difficult moment, the two of us just burst into tears. And so I started this journey to kind of uncover the backstory to this piece of music and why, when you know, you go to any performance of this remarkable work and people around you will be weeping, either from religious devotion or because it's a thing that they heard with relatives or loved ones who have passed away, or, you know, it's a piece of music that gets to the heart of people in such a deep way. And I wanted to understand how that was entwined with the story of its creation.
I must say, because I went and listened to this particular recording, having read the beginning of your book, I listened to Comfort Ye with fresh ears. I think I'd always thought, oh, well, that's just how Messiah starts, you know, and then it kind of moves on to all of the other famous bits. But it's a remarkable bit of music, Comfort Ye My People, about, as I said, an accompanied recitative. And the way in which it's very reassuring, the music, but it also stops and starts a great deal, as though it's trying over and over again to comfort ye.
That's right. I mean, it feels like the piece is sort of trying to take off, and it comes in, you know, after that wonderful two-part overture or symphony, as Handel called it. And I always think of that tenor coming up above the orchestra as being almost like a kind of trumpet blast. You know, it's announcing something, it's calling you to attention, it's telling you that something big and important is on the table here. The text itself I always find so meaningful because it's from the 40th chapter of the book of Isaiah. And in that passage, the prophet is not saying, "Be ye comforted." The text is really about, in a world of disorder and trouble, you need to be the one to do the comforting. And, you know, when you sort of understand the biblical text that Handel's working with here, it has all of these layers of meaning to it, I think, that are only enhanced by the music.
Yes, and I am amazed over and over how works that were composed in this case nearly 300 years ago can reach out to us and work their magic still, and perhaps in slightly different ways to the ways in which the composers intended.
Yeah, I mean, this piece of music has been in near continuous performance, you know, since the time it was composed. And you can't really say that about much else in the classical canon. You know, composers had to be revived over time, but Handel's Messiah really hasn't. And I think in some ways that's because it's inscribed with the moment of its creation. You know, it was created in a time of war and dissension and disease and ever-present death and real worry about the present state of the world and of the possibility of a better one. And that is written into the text, of course. It's drawing from the Hebrew prophets and the New Testament in this sort of search for hope. But it's one of the most remarkable examples, I think, of the way in which words and music can work together to create more than the sum of their parts.
Perhaps you could situate for us Handel in 18th century London. He pitched up as a kind of successful young opera composer, a German, and then he had much, much more success in London, and he became the toast of the town, didn't he?
He did. I mean, he arrived in London as when he was still employed by the Elector of Hanover. He was originally born in what would later become Germany. He had sort of cut his teeth as a young musician in Italy, which was, of course, the place you wanted to go at the time that, you know, we would later come to call the Baroque period of music, where he was really learning the craft. But at this stage, Italian opera is all the rage. And fresh from Venice and Rome and Naples, you know, he arrives in London with this incredible artistic ability right at the leading edge of this new art form that's taking London by storm. He becomes really well known in what's emerging as the theater district, the West End of London, performing these new original pieces that everybody is just sort of clamoring for. And we now think of Baroque music as sort of all, you know, frilly cuffs and rather mannered. But at the time, this music was new and experimental, and it was breaking all of the rules. And it was a thing that young people loved and young people engaged in. We have to sort of remember that. This is a youthful musical movement that Handel is at the absolute center of. And he had already made a reputation for himself in Italy and the German lands, and so his reputation kind of preceded him, but he's almost immediately known to everyone as this new and exciting composer.
And not just a new and exciting composer, but a businessman as well, an impresario, an entrepreneur. He really is doing everything, isn't he? And including inventing the opera company.
That's right. I mean, thinking about performance, music as a kind of business that has to sustain itself, and thinking about all the economic models that might allow a company to survive, not only wealthy patronage or noble patronage, but also creating a joint stock company, for example, that will sustain a production company over time. He is a person who is thinking creatively in all sorts of different levels, both artistic and economic and administrative at this moment. And, you know, in that way, we have to think of him as a composer for the public and for the stage. He once said famously, "Oh, that I had cannon." You know, if he could have any other thing that would be loud and boisterous and have an effect on an audience, he would do it. And that's so evident in Messiah, I think, because he wants you to feel something. And he has spent so much of his career perfecting the craft of how to do that on a musical page.
Yeah. By the time of Messiah, a lot of things had changed in London and in Handel's life, and he was no longer the toast of the town. People were no longer interested in Italian opera, and he had to reinvent himself. Now, perhaps this is where we introduce Charles Jennings.
Handel had many, many admirers. He had collaborated with many artists, both professional and amateur, over his time in London. He was, you know, the absolute center of court life. By this stage, he was court composer to George I and George II, and he had created the coronation anthems for George II's coronation, Westminster Abbey, Zadok the Priest, which is, you know, still performed most recently at Charles III's coronation. But he was sort of on the back end of success in various ways. He was venerated as a composer, but perhaps less admired and considered less on the front edge of things than he had been when he first arrived in London. But the person who thought of him as almost godlike as an artist was Charles Jennings, who was a wealthy Leicestershire landowner, rather accomplished amateur musician. He attended every performance he could possibly go to. He collected Handel's music and had one of the great music libraries in Britain at this time. But he also was a person who suffered very deeply from a thing that in the 18th century was called the hip, HYP. We might now call it bipolar disorder or chronic depression. And at some point in the late 1730s, perhaps as late as 1740 or 41, he sat down in his library to try to, in a way, write himself out of this horrible, encasing sense of doom. And the place he turned as a believing Christian was to the scriptures, the Hebrew prophets, the New Testament, the Book of Revelation, the Gospels, and started arranging Bible verses in an order that was not chronological and not biblical, but in an order that made sense to him. And that became the text of Messiah. Handel had no idea his friend and patron Jennings was doing this, and you can imagine the kind of manuscript just sort of pitching up at Handel's door. But what Jennings had created was his own kind of ladder out of this abyss. So that when we listen to Messiah today, we're hearing not only Handel's music, but a set of words that this dark, deeply depressed man, Jennings, wanted us to hear in this precise order. It's his philosophical journey toward the possibility of hope.
Behold, I tell you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet.
We shall be changed.
That's Thomas Kvasthoff singing The Trumpet Shall Sound from Handel's Messiah, which is the subject of today's music show. My guest is Charles King. And as you said, Charles, philosophical is the important word here because it's not really dramatic in the way that a Bach passion is dramatic, you know, telling a story. Well, it tells a mystery in those words of St. Paul.
That's right. I tell you a mystery. It is Janin's sort of working through the theological and philosophical essence of Christianity on the one hand, but I think more broadly, he's trying to work through how you possibly have hope in a world in which all of the evidence of your senses would suggest otherwise, would convince you otherwise. You know, what does faith in the possibility of a better world look like? What if you began with the idea that things are going to be okay and then worked your way back to a more hopeful world? What if you reasoned not from experience, but against experience? And that's why I think he selected that Comfort Ye text. You know, every performance of Messiah, since it was first composed, since it was first performed, begins with a promise. It's that promise, comfort ye my people. Speak ye comfortably to Jerusalem and cry unto her that her warfare is accomplished, her iniquity is pardoned. In other words, you know, begin with the idea that things are going to work out for the better. And then we'll step back and go through the story of the Passion. We'll go through suffering. You know, we'll go to the depths of human despair, but we're going to start with the idea that things are going to cosmically be good in the end.
You say that Handel didn't know that Jennings was doing this. And after he sent the libretto to Handel, Jennings didn't know that Handel was actually putting it to music, did he?
That's right.
Handel went silent.
They were both behind this kind of veil, you know. They worked on things together, but Jennings felt that this was his greatest work, and he wanted Handel to apply his entire genius, as he put it, to this text. And when he finally arrived in London in the autumn of 1741, and he learned that Handel was no longer in London, that he had actually gone out of town, he was furious because, first of all, there was going to be nothing new that Handel was going to offer that season, and Jennings always looked forward to Handel's new compositions as a kind of balm for his own depression. But even worse, Handel had already set this text to music and then ran off with it. And there were many times that their friendship was sort of tested, and this was really one of them.
When he finally heard what Handel had done, and we're sort of jumping ahead a bit here to the following Easter, he wasn't actually completely approving, was he? Because Handel had written this piece very, very quickly, 3 weeks and a bit, for the whole of Messiah. And one of the ways in which he'd been able to do it so quickly is that he'd recycled things, which is a very Baroque conceit, bits of opera and so on, and put Jennings' words to music that he'd already composed in a few instances. And you point out in the book something that had never occurred to me, that this is one of the reasons that some of the word setting in Messiah isn't very good. I just assumed it was because Handel was German. But actually, it's also because he's trying to cram these words into existing music. So, for unto us a child is born, rather than for unto us a child is born, is because of the music.
That's right. It's totally unnatural cadence in English, and he's setting it to an Italian duet that he had composed sometime earlier, and it just so happens that the stress is really on that first word. So, for in English, but no in the original Italian.
Thank you.
So this was, as you say, completely common in this period, and it's rather common in our period, right? It's why blockbuster musicals will often have elements that sound very, very similar. You know, composers are composing quickly. They're composing for the stage. When you find something that works, you should really stick with it and, you know, and try it as much as possible. And Handel in particular, I think precisely because he was not a native English speaker, could hear some of the cadences, the rhythms of English better than a native speaker probably could. So, for example, the word forever, which in different compositions of his, he loves as the syncopated rhythm, forever and ever and ever. It just suggests itself as a natural thing to do on a musical staff. And so Handel uses that over and over. But when Jennings finally heard this, which was sometime after the original performance, he was rather peeved. That first of all, that Handel had used all of these pre-existing conventions in a way that he found rather cheap. He didn't like the word setting. The original word book, which was kind of like the printed libretto, kind of like almost a playbill that, you know, you could get at the performance, had all sorts of printer's errors in it. He thought that Handel had not applied his entire genius to it. And he said, you know, I am never going to offer Handel these sacred words again to be so abused.
I think maybe this is the point at which we should pause and move into some of the other characters in your book, and then we'll come back to Messiah and its first and subsequent performances. But we need to remember that this is a time, the mid-18th century, when most of the wealth of Europe was the result of slavery, of the slave trade. And Handel and Jennings themselves were, you know, a part of this, however tangentially.
That's right. I mean, and I really wanted to have a character whose life kind of intertwined with the lives of other people in this period. And the character I use in the book is named Ayuba Jallo, who was captured on the west coast of Africa, shipped across the Atlantic, sold into slavery on the docks of Annapolis, Maryland, which is really not very far from where I live, eventually escaped. He came to the attention of some local officials who wrote down his story, and through a whole series of really quite incredible coincidences, his story makes it back to the Royal African Company, which was one of the major trading and enslaving firms of the time, who bought his freedom in large part because they thought that Jallo, as an educated multilingual Muslim from West Africa, might actually be of use to them in expanding their interests along the West Coast. And he pitches up in London at exactly the same time that Jennings is thinking about how do you write the story of this kind of returning prince. And in fact, we don't have any evidence that the two of them ever met, but they would have been exactly in the same circles. In fact, so many of the people who are involved in buying Jallo's freedom were actually also patrons of Handel's. And when Jallo was in London, they were very keen to show him all of the fruits of British civilization. So it wouldn't have been unusual if Jallo were even at a Handel performance in the 1730s. But one of the things that in trying to tell Jallo's story that just really amazed me is that I came across the fact that he was inducted into an organization called the Spalding Gentlemen's Society when he was in London, which was one of these sort of local academies for notables and men of science of the time. And if you look at a membership list of the Spalding Gentlemen's Society, two lines away from each other on the membership list are Jennings and Jallo. Remarkable fact that a person who was sold into slavery, whose very life in many ways became one of the commodities that supported art and commerce and the theater and wealth in general in this period, and the truest creator of Messiah appear on the same document together. So I thought it was really important not to forget the ways in which Jennings is a shareholder in the South Sea Company, or Handel, who received portions of his salary through holding accounts in the Royal African Company, that the story of enslavement is absolutely entwined with art in this period in a way that we simply can't deny.
And we should finish the story of Jallo by pointing out that the Royal African Company got their wish, didn't they? He did go back there and work for them.
They did. And that's a complicating factor in how we tell these stories as well, because he became an employee of the Royal African Company. When he was in London, his portrait was painted. It now hangs as one of the really remarkable and perhaps earliest portrait of a person of African heritage in the National Portrait Gallery in London, as a subject looking full on at the viewer, not as a sort of individual scurrying sort of in the background, but a person with dignity and purpose as an individual. And it's incredible. It hangs looking right out at the viewer today.
On today's music show, I'm speaking to Charles King, who's the author of a book called Every Valley, The Story of Handel's Messiah. And it's also the story of people involved with Handel's Messiah, including the first performers, which brings us to Susanna Sibber, who is a remarkable woman with a remarkable story that could be the subject of a book in itself, Charles.
That's absolutely right. And Susanna Sibber, or Susanna Arne, as she was originally called, was one of these people who was sort of coming up on the fringes of the burgeoning musical scene in London in the early 18th century. She didn't come from wealth. Her father was an upholsterer. Her mother was a midwife. But even her parents realized that if you wanted to make it in London in the 17-teens, one of the ways you might consider doing it was by forming an opera company. And so the family created this small opera company. They arranged for music lessons for her. Her brother Thomas, and some of those lessons probably passed down to Susanna. And they were starting to put on performances of their own when her rather enterprising father realized that the best way to get the family into the music and performance business was to marry into it. And so probably with his own conniving, Susanna was engaged and then married to a man named Theophilus Sibber, who is the son of Colley Sibber, one of the great impresarios of the day, a theater manager and poet laureate of the United Kingdom and so on. So this, you know, now the family fortune was made. And her brother Thomas Arne would go on to become one of the great composers of the 18th century, the creator of Rule Britannia, among other things. But Theophilus, Thomas Arne's now brother-in-law, turned out to be an absolute nightmare. He was drunk much of the time. He had incredible gambling debts. He slept his way around a cast. He was much older than Susanna. And he reckoned that at some point, this young, attractive wife of his, with a growing stage career and stage presence, could be kind of the vehicle of his own enrichment. And he started arranging for meetings between his wife and wealthy young men who would hang around the stage door, essentially pimping out his wife to pay his gambling debts. And her life became really quite miserable by this stage. And in one of the letters that she wrote to Theophilus, she said, "You've made of my life a dying by inches." So much so that she at some point turned to one of these men, the wealthy son of a parliamentarian, a man named William Sloper, by her account, really fell in love with him. She would eventually bear at least one child with Sloper. And at that point, however, when she started meeting with Sloper privately, Theophilus was enraged because now this thing that had once been a business arrangement now looked like an affair. And in 1738, he sued William Sloper for the alienation of the affections of his wife. And when that trial opened, Susanna's life effectively ended as she saw it, because the most intimate details of her private life were aired in a London courtroom, and people took down a transcript and sold it, and people created pornographic cartoons about this weird threesome relationship that was now all of the rage, you know, famous people of the stage doing scandalous things behind closed doors. And then he sued again in 1739 and kept winning money in these cases against Susanna's lover. And then by that stage, she just disappears until a couple of years later, she happens to turn up in exactly the same place that Handel does, which is in Dublin.
And this is when she enters the story of Messiah, because she sings in the first performance. And not only does she sing in it, she gets, you know, in a way, one of the prize arias of it, one which is incredibly close to home.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, at this point, Handel has pitched up in Dublin because he has an invitation to essentially do what amounts to a greatest hits tour. And in fact, Handel may have invented the concept of a greatest hits tour as a way of kind of restarting his career in London. So he's invited to Dublin. He's staging a whole series of concerts of his work, but he wants to premiere in the spring of 1742, this new work of music that he is carrying in his baggage, the setting of the words, the libretto that has been created by Charles Jennens. And he's looking around for artists, as you would. You know, Handel always went to war with the army he had. He had to put together an orchestra, singers, chorus, wherever he could find them. And he learned that Susanna Cibber was also performing at a local theater in Dublin. And he approached her, asked her if she would be one of the soloists in the premiere of this new work of music. And when she stepped forward from the chorus to sing one of the arias that Handel had given her, people sometimes think it was written for her, but it wasn't. It just happened to align with her life. It brought down the house because she stood in front of the 700 or so people gathered in Mr. Neal's Music Hall on Fishamble Street and sang, "He was despised, he was rejected, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief." And everyone in the room could do the gender switch, you know. They knew that she, the scandalous, notorious woman, was now standing before them, singing about the possibility of redemption. I mean, it was a movie-worthy moment far before the invention of film. This individual who was singing about the possibility of redemption, of resurrection even, inside of a piece of music dedicated to that same theological story, everyone understood the significance of this moment.
Acquainted with grief.
That's He Was Despised from Handel's Messiah. We heard it sung by Carolyn Watkinson with the Academy of Ancient Music, directed by Christopher Hogwood. On today's music show, I'm speaking to Charles King, who is the author of Every Valley, the Story of Handel's Messiah. Charles, listening to Carolyn Watkinson sing it makes me really want to hear Susanna Sibber, because she was, you say in the book, she didn't actually have much of a voice, but she had incredible stage personality, and she sort of personified the music as much as sang it.
That's right. She was already, I mean, her voice was rather thin. She probably had to be taken through the music by Handel rather than just looking at a sheet of music and reading it as a singer. Before the scandal with her husband Theophilus and William Sloper, she was already gaining a reputation for being able to kind of inhabit a character and make an audience empathize with what was happening on stage. And that became even more the case after this great triumph of hers in Dublin, because when she went back to London, the news of her singing in this new piece of music by Handel had preceded her. And she would go on to become really the most celebrated tragedian of the 18th century. She was the female equivalent after this of the great actor David Garrick. And in fact, the two of them appeared frequently together on stage, the greatest male and female leads of that time. And she would go on to be buried in the North Cloister of Westminster Abbey, just a kind of a wall away from where Handel is.
The fact that Handel's Messiah had its premiere in Dublin just before Easter, or just after Easter, it was anyway spring, is perhaps surprising to us today, because a lot of people think of this as a Christmas piece, but there's not very much Christmas music in Messiah, and I wonder at what point it became a Christmas piece. Do we know?
Well, it really slid to Christmas over the course of the 19th century. Already by the 1830s and 1840s, people around the world were quite accustomed to hearing it at Christmas time. There's no one performance that establishes that tradition. It's just a kind of thing that seemed to develop over time. But you're absolutely right. The story is very much an Easter story, and that's, of course, why Handel wrote it. Its form is an oratorio, which is essentially, you know, an opera, often on sacred themes, but without all of the costumes and the running about that you would typically have in an Italian opera, say. So it's more sedate, it's appropriate for the Lenten season, and especially if it's on a sacred theme, then it's appropriate for that time of the year. And it's, in its essence, about the possibility of a new beginning, of hope, of the possibility of the world being better than it appears to you right at the moment. So one should listen to it at both those holiday seasons, I think, because it will have a very different feeling to it. If you associate it with, you know, the smell of spruce and warm spices in the Christmas season. But then if you associate it with daffodils and new beginnings and the greening of the world during the Easter season, it appears very different yet again.
Yes, of course, we listen to it here in Australia in intense heat for Christmas.
Right, exactly.
And in autumn. So there you
That's
go.
That's right. Well, you know, you make a good point, which is that I think for every single generation in very different kinds of geographic locations and even different cultures, people have found Messiah to be a kind of message in a bottle. It feels eternally relevant. All of these big questions that Jennings selected from the sacred scriptures, you know, why do the nations so furiously rage together? Why do the people imagine a vain thing? All of these sort of great texts that feel like they're just written for our moment, regardless of the season.
We have to finish this conversation soon, but we can't, I think, before we've mentioned Thomas Coram and the Foundling Hospital, because Handel and this piece, Messiah, become associated with the establishment of the Foundling Hospital. Could you tell us briefly the story of Coram?
When the performance ends in Dublin and Handel goes back to London, he has a few more performances of it there. It debuts and premieres in 1743, a couple more performances in 1745. And then it probably just would have disappeared into history, like some of Handel's operas that are very rarely performed now. But it was really because of the Foundling Hospital, the brainchild of Thomas Coram, which became one of the great philanthropic projects of the 1740s. Handel was asked by the governors of the Foundling Hospital to essentially put on a fundraiser. And he repurposed some of the music from Messiah, and later in the 1750s began offering a Messiah performance as an annual fundraising event for the Foundling Hospital. And that's where most people then first heard this piece of music. And it was forever associated with not just beautiful music, but music that was in aid of a good cause. And that was all down to the vision of Coram.
Every Valley, the title of your book, Charles King, is from the line, "Every valley shall be exalted." And I had forgotten until reading your book that this is a verse also from the prophet Isaiah that was a favorite of Martin Luther King, and indeed that was included in his "I Have a Dream" speech, given not so very far from where you're living in Washington. Perhaps we can bring it back to that and the significance of that particular line for not so much Handel, but for our times, or for King's times at least.
I mean, this is part of the brilliance of Charles Jennings sort of selecting that text, because it's kind of a method for how you get to hope. The first step in changing the world is to reimagine the world. Like, think of the world in a radically new way, that the high shall be low, you know, that every valley shall be exalted, every mountain and hill made low, the rough places plain, the crooked straight. That if you really want to affect some kind of radical change, you first have to interpret the world, see the world differently. And that's what I think King was getting at. It's what Jennings had pulled from the scriptures, and it's what Handel so brilliantly then put to memorable music.
And it's why we can hear that music with fresh ears today.
Yeah, exactly right. Once again, you know, every aspect of Messiah feels like it was written for us. And that's where Charles Jennings, I think, was living the idea of "comfort ye." He's being the one through all of these centuries to offer, through Handel's genius, some kind of comfort to us.
Well, thank you very much, Charles King, for comforting us today on The Music Show, talking about your book, Every Valley, The Story of Handel's Messiah. It's published by the Bodley Head. It's been very, very good to talk to you, and it was a real pleasure to read the book.
Thank you so much. It's really nice to be with you.
Every valley shall be exalted, shall be exalted.
Every Valley from Handel's Messiah. And that recording, which you heard quite a few times on today's show, is the Academy of Ancient Music, the choir of Christ Church Cathedral, Oxford, and Christopher Hogwood conducting. You'll find full details on the music show's website. And Charles King's book, Every Valley, The Desperate Lives and Troubled Times That Made Handel's Messiah, is published by the Bodley Head. Coming up on the music show, remembering the full-throated and fully modern composer Luciano Berio. It's his centenary this year, and my guest is going to be the ABC chair, Kim Williams, who was once a composition student of Berio's. And we'll also meet a Brisbane folk band called Amity, and they're going to get us dancing.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.